Welcome to the All Out Coach Podcast. My name is Tim Michelashvili, and I'm your host. This is the place where we capture our ideas and some of our most memorable conversations with a global approach that's deeply rooted in sportsmanship and a scientific curiosity. Today, I have a special guest who's a biopharmaceutical industry executive for over 25 years. He's worked and led medical teams across different, very well-known, established organizations in oncology and immunology, such as AbbVie, Shire, Baxalta. He also is a certified high performance coach, as well as a mentor in the inaugural global mentorship program at the Medical Affairs Professional Society, MAPS. And I'm very fortunate to consider him my mentor, my friend, also my former colleague, whom I've known for many years, not just my colleague, but also my manager, rather, my manager with three layers above in our organizations, in the structure of our organizations, in fact. And he certified me when I joined a very innovative company called Baxalta, which was a success story, and which focused on immunodeficiencies and primary immunodeficiencies and rare disease. In fact, this was a company where the first question during the orientation was, what is your legacy? So you can understand why this was a memorable organization for me. I'd like to welcome Leon Rosen, who's going to talk to us about how to influence the lives and the leaders in business today. Leon, welcome. I'm so glad to have you here on All Out Coach.
Thanks, Tim. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you for the introduction. I have to say that I'm pretty honored to be able to call you my friend and teammate as well. Thank you.
The feeling is mutual, absolutely mutual, Leon. And the very first lesson that I remember from you, where I realized that you're not only a global medical affairs leader in our organization, but someone who was a true coach with a great sense of humor as well, and with a very unique personality, was when you told this entire medical team about the primary goal of our communication, how what we communicate has to be consistent with the message that we intend to convey to people, which oftentimes we forget. And the way you had presented that concept and the passion with which you had presented and the tone was one for that for me was a turning point, you know, and how I wanted to ask you for advice and consider you my mentor. So I'm really glad to have you also join from Australia. So you're a guest who has joined from the farthest location so far.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure you're going to get anybody to join from further away than Australia. We are sort of right at the very bottom of the world and a long way from anywhere, but which has its advantages and disadvantages. And it's interesting, you talked about communication, and I remember that because that's it is something that's really important to me in terms of the message. And, you know, in the end, your meaning of your communication is what the other person walks away with. And so you have to be really clear in what you want them to walk away with and in making sure that that's what they walk away with. And I'll give you a little example, and it's one that I think about sometimes a lot. If you email someone with the expectation of a response, and there's no response, right? And it's an interesting thing. You know, one of the challenges with email is that we expect this instantaneous response, and then we think, oh, we'll give the person an hour because maybe they're at lunch, and, you know, some of these unreasonable expectations. But let's say you get an email from someone and you decide you're not going to respond. That's fine. However, what it means is that you don't know what that person takes as the meaning behind your lack of response. It may mean nothing to them. It may mean that they think you're busy. It may mean to them that you don't like them. It may mean that, they think, oh, you know, I don't really want to work with this person. Yeah. This is too hard, or I don't want to answer the question. So just bear in mind that even no response and even no communication is communication. And if you don't respond to someone, and this is not just about emails, take it to wherever they want to take it in terms of what they see as the meaning behind your communication. So, you know, most of the time it doesn't matter, but just to keep that in the back of your mind, because I think that is really important in just relationships.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you very much. I'm not going to ask you many questions. I've known you for many years during this conversation. But instead, what I thought would be, interesting would be to get your opinion and your perspective on certain statements that I find interesting or intriguing. So I look forward to some of your lessons, any stories that you can share with us or anything that inspires you from some of these comments that I will share with you. So the first one is, if we were forced to take leadership courses from childhood, then maybe leadership would not be such a foreign language for us as adults.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And I find the concept of a leadership language really interesting as well. I'm not quite sure. I have to be honest, I'm not quite sure what that means. And I think, you know, when you're in the corporate world and you've been in it for a little while, you realize that the language changes all the time. And, you know, so there's a whole, you know, different concepts come in and there's a whole lot of euphemisms that are used because, you know, you don't want to upset people. And so, you know, we start to use euphemisms a lot, and we start to use terminology that we sort of understand what the hidden meaning behind that phrase is, but we don't really want to say what it really is. And I know sometimes that I will fall into that at home, and you know, my wife will ask me something or we'll be talking and I will fall into what she calls middle management speak, and she'll say stop talking middle management and just tell me what's going on. So I think yes, there is a language, but I think part of that language is really about our actions and our behaviors. And so I think, you know, in terms of teaching children, it's about teaching them the behaviors, which I think are just basic and common sense and common decency and respect. You know, you respect other people, you meet them where they are, you communicate, honestly and openly.
Who were some of the people that shaped your idea of leadership early on?
So, and I think, you know, where I saw that was actually the two people that I see in my childhood who influenced me the most were my father, who was basically a reasonably quiet man. You know, he would talk, but you know, he would tell you what he thought. He never left you sort of wondering where he stood on things, but he never did it in a derogatory way. I never felt that he was putting me down or, you know, anything like that. It was, okay, Here's what it is, and I want to teach you. And so that was a big influence. The other influence was one of my brothers, who was he was the most caring person I've ever met. And it wasn't that he said things. We used to call him Captain Pracy because his conversations were extremely short. I would ring him on the phone, and you know, he wouldn't even say goodbye. He would just hang up and go off and do the next thing. And so he could come across as really rude, but that wasn't what it was about. And he would always be there if you needed him. He would give you advice, and it would be honest and open. So I think, you know, we need to have those behaviours, you know, modelled, you know, for our kids.
Mm-hmm. Leadership, I often say, is a way of life. It's your choice. It's never given to you. Was there a turning point in your life when you chose leadership and you took it in your own hands?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if I ever chose leadership. I'm not quite sure how that works. So I know I can remember being, you know, as an MD in the hospital, and, you know, you would be part of a team. And remember, we're talking, I graduated almost almost 40 years ago. So, you know, that was a long time ago. And obviously, you know, the way things worked in hospitals and relationships between the different healthcare providers was very different to what it was today. The way I saw it at the time, and this was just the way, my way of life, I guess, was that everybody in the team, whoever it was, you know, had an opinion. And that opinion was of value. It certainly was of value to them, and I should respect that. And I was not, I did not have a monopoly on good ideas or on knowledge. So, you know, some, I would listen to what other people had said, but I would always have in the back of my mind, where does the buck stop? The buck stops with me. So at some point I need to, I guess, make a decision. And that was how I approached being part of a team in medicine. You know, everybody had a valuable input. Someone at the end had to make a decision. It might not even be me, but at that, that's that point. I think, you know, the next role I got after I left the hospital was actually as the medical director of a blood bank. And I had no idea what a blood bank did or anything along those lines. I was 26 at the time, and look, I'll be honest, a reasonably naive 26, and I was suddenly put in charge of the blood supply for a million people in Sydney, in the west of Sydney, and I had 40 staff, which included all of the nursing staff, the laboratory staff, the admin staff, you know, even the drivers of the buses and those sorts of things, and the truck, delivery truck. You know, again, it was the same sort of philosophy. So I never sort of said I was the leader. I sort of guess I knew it, but I was just the person in the team who made final decision. That's a strange way of looking at it. And I, you know, I had a vision and I wanted people to come along with those visions, but people worked with me, not for me.
Yeah, that's how I felt. That's how I know the team felt when I had the honor of working with you on your team. So here's the next statement that I want to read to you. Look at life as a sport, not war, as no matter how tough it gets, there are winners in sports, but no winners in wars. So I know I've spoken to you about your interest in various sports and talked about sportsmanship at the beginning of this podcast. Is there any sports inspiration to your performance coaching, Leon?
Yeah, there is. So I'm a big fan of Australian rules football, which may be foreign to lots of people who are listening to the podcast. Great game, best game in the world.
I followed it. I learned the rules a long time ago. So.
So I have my team that I support, it's interesting because they're going through a whole lot of turmoil at the moment, just like any business or any organization. You know, with a board spill, and they've got rid of their chairman and they've got rid of their coach, and there's all sorts of stuff going on. But I think, you know, it's that sort of quote about, you know, a champion team will beat a team of champions anytime. And it is about the team. You know, one person, they might have the best player that's ever played, but they need the rest of the team. One person can't make that difference or can't win it for you. So I think there's that. But, you know, it's a sport that's very tough. You know, there's no padding and injuries are a big part of the game. I played it a little bit when I was younger. Not very well, but I played it. You know, one of the things that I learnt was that, and that I've heard a lot of times as well, is that when you're going in to do something, you know, in terms of injury, if you pull back a little bit because you're scared, if you pull back a little bit because you don't want to get injured, you're actually more likely to get injured than if you just go in full on. If you do something your all, number one, you're more likely to succeed at it, but number two, you're a little bit less likely to get injured and hurt, you know, on the way. So I think, you know, that's a lesson that you can take into life. you just go and all out on things, and you're much more likely to succeed and succeed well.
I'm very glad about that. And, you know, I'm partial to believe that there's a study and there's research that supports all that. But it seems like that's also been your experience, not just the research of what, right? Would you?
Yeah. I mean, in watching the game, you can see people who pull back and, I think really relaxing into it and giving it everything you've got is critical. And even if it's not necessarily true for sport, though I believe it is, it's certainly true for life. If you only go in half-hearted, you've got a much less chance to succeed, and you won't quite know where to learn the lesson, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Leon, as a follow-up, do you think that it's your interest in sports, your early training and, you know, attempts and just participation in sports that inspired the competitiveness out of you in order to excel throughout your career? Do you think that, and to be competitive, to stay competitive? Or?
That's a really tough question. That whole nature versus nurture. And I don't believe it's one or the other. I think it's a bit of both. So I think, people have a tendency towards it, and then that tendency is, might be great or it might be small, but that tendency is there. And then depending on what happens in their life and their life experiences, it will magnify that intensity or that tendency to action. And some people don't need a lot to, to be called to action. Some people need quite a significant life event to be called to action. And we've all heard of those stories of people who have, turned themselves around and, up to that point, where really that competitive. And I think it's also about whether you're competitive with yourself or competitive with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going back to that example that I talked to you about at Baxalta, where I had received probably the most extensive training I had ever received at any company, 3 months dedicated training from a PhD who was an expert in the field, after which you certified me, you and my manager and his management, of course. But I remember that feedback that you had provided and the tone with which you had provided, how constructive it was, and how how you recognized my efforts and as well. So you definitely don't come across as a person who considers that there are winners in wars. So this leads me to my next statement. And because I haven't revealed the author of any of these statements, I'll do so now. The reason why there was no author, it's actually yours truly here, All Out Coach. These are just some of my reflections. So but I'm always testing them. I'm always testing them, Leon. And that's why I get other people's perspectives and getting live feedback from you. The next one is the following. Inspire all your employees to be sports athletes and scientists, regardless of their background. Do you think such a business is possible? Why or why not? What are some disadvantages or advantages to that kind of mindset?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is that they're not mutually exclusive. When you talk about mindset, yes, I think the approach is different, but it's not one approach versus another. So, some of the best sports athletes, will actually have a scientific basis to what they're doing in their performance. So I think the two go together. And I think, when I look at really good sports people, really good athletes, I think what strikes me about them is their ability to essentially perform over the long term. And that takes, it's their self-discipline, it's their consistency, it's their, work ethic, it's their, okay, I'm going, it's their focus. Right? Mm-hmm. not succeed as an athlete if you don't have those things, if you don't do the training, if you don't look after yourself, if you don't recover. It's not just about going out there and performing or playing that sport or doing the run or whatever it happens to be. There's a whole lot of other stuff in terms of preparation and you know, recovery that goes towards it as well. So there's a real discipline that goes to it. And then I think the scientist is really somebody who looks at things and says, okay, I want to understand this. I want to understand why it's happening. And I'm open-minded about it. So in some ways, I think of a scientist as an open-minded skeptic. In other words, mm-hmm. here is something that's presented to them. They're going to test it, like you're testing your words, right? Yeah. That, to me, is the scientific method. And So, like I said, the two are not mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to agree with you, Leon. Reflecting back on how I have always been inspired by competition and how I would create games out of anything. Like I was the only child, you know, growing up, and whether it was a still jump, long jump, or create baseball games, even though we didn't have any baseball bats or baseballs growing up in the Republic of Georgia. I think I started a group of my classmates who were probably the first ones in the whole country who knew about baseball. I had looked up, you know, the rules, and we used textbooks and erasers or tennis balls, believe it or not. So I've always been fascinated by competition, different rules, you know, how relevant they are, how reproducible they are. But at the same time, my best memories are from being on championship teams, whether it's in high school or in college. So, what really inspired that quote also is the hypothesis that I have that if you create the kind of environment in a team, such as the one that I was a part of when I was at Vaxalta, for example, where you were, you know, leading our team. I think even a person who's a janitor, right, who doesn't require a lot of extensive training or experience, is going to try to research that, you know, that next best detergent that they can use next time they come into office to clean. Because I believe it is possible. To be competitive, yet to be very collaborative as well, you know, with sportsmanship and with curiosity, scientific curiosity as well. So you mentioned performance, Leon. I think performance is different from success. So what is your perspective on how performance is different from success?
That's a really good question. So the high performance coaching that I do, really, you know, you got to think about, okay, I'm going to coach someone to high performance. So what does high performance mean? What is a high performer? And a high performer generally is somebody who is able to demonstrate, and the word success comes to mind, but is able to, you know, be a leader in their field and an expert in their field consistently over a period of time. So to me, performance is not episodic. You know, high performance and good performance is over time. And you need to have that to be a success. So there's no such thing as an overnight success. People need to pay their dues. So I think success can be episodic. So you can go out there and you can perform and you can have a success, however you define that, and you can define that any way you want. But that doesn't mean you will continue to have success. Being a high performer, generally, if you're doing the right things, you will have some success because you're performing to your goals, right? To get to your goals. So if you're getting to your goals, that's a success. So mm-hmm. I think it's about, number one, we've got to be careful how we define success. Are we defining that internally, or is that an external? So, you know, I'm going to be the CMO of the biggest pharmaceutical right. company in the world. And that's the only definition of success. Well, only one person at a time can do that. So that's a really tough definition. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be aiming for it, but need to think about what that definition is. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is, you know, performance is really about that consistent application and consistent discipline.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that perspective. I certainly have talked about this difference before in All Out Coach, and you know, I've presented it somewhat as, you know, performance is a talent, right, or some a skill that you have, and success is something that other people recognize you as being an expert in. Which may be outside of your control. And the reason why I asked the question was to, you know, get your opinion, of course, on, you know, to help understand why is it that some people are very talented and they never win awards, they never get recognition, they're not those overnight successes that which you did mention, right? And maybe there is an upper bound of just how good can you be in the 100 meter, dash, for example. So those are some of the previous conversations that I've had, just to give you some background on that. And I like that long-term perspective that you provided on performance, being a high-performance coach, that you have a long-term approach. And that success may be defined individually, right?
I think that's the challenge. And you mentioned about success being defined externally, and, uh-huh. and yes, you know, when we're in the corporate world, and we're working for, you know, a manager, and uh-huh. you know, we have there's a set of company goals, and they all flow yeah. down to individual goals. You don't define what your success looks like. Right. So there are some people who perform very well, but may not get recognized for all sorts of reasons. So I think, mm-hmm. you know, as I said, you've got to think about what is your internal definition of success.
Okay.
And then obviously there's the external definition.
Okay. Yeah. Great. But great.
That's a whole other podcast, Tim.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. We'll have it, episode number two, continuation of it. Yes. So you mentioned the corporate environment and some competition or some goals, right? Leon, do you consider hiring your team members a contest, a competition, a negotiation, a conversation? What is your perspective on, your personal perspective on how do you hire those most successful, highest performing, you know, team members?
Yeah. So I think I've had success and non-success in hiring people, and I think everybody does. When I'm interviewing, so often the company will have an interview structure that you need to follow. Yep. So yep. they will have their series of questions, and especially their behavioral based questions, and you will choose one to demonstrate a particular behavior that the company happens to be interested in. I think the stricter that is, certainly from my perspective, the stricter that is, the harder I find it to interview someone. Mm-hmm. Because the way I look at it is there's two parts to being successful at a job. One is, does the person have the technical skills or the ability to learn the technical skills? Mm-hmm. And then the second part is the vaguer part of it, the more ethereal part. Are they a good fit for the team? Which is, you know, the euphemism for, we didn't really like you all that much, we don't think you're going to fit.
Yeah, you're not a good fit.
Yeah, right.
Based on our definition, right?
Yeah. But, you know, are they the right fit? You know, are they going to, you know, be able to have the skills or learn the skills that they're going to need to be able to put that technical knowledge to best use? And for an MSL, the other question I would always ask myself is this a person that I want to represent the company and to represent me? Right. Mm-hmm. So that's always in the back of my mind, because the MSL's at the coal face.
So
my interviewing tends to be more a conversation. It's about really getting to know the person. One of the questions that I ask is, I will ask the person to close their eyes and just go back to a peak experience in their life. So uh-huh. a point in time when they felt really energized, you know, right. really satisfied and proud of what they had just achieved. And when they get to that point, I ask them what it is that they've just done and right. why they're feeling that way. And it's a really great insight into what makes that person tick. So for example, my peak experience is a job that I had where I led a team. It was dysfunctional at the beginning. It was functional at the end. We got recognized internally. The individuals were being developed. They were moving on within the organization. And I felt like, you know, with a team, we had got to the top of that mountain together, and we were all standing up there bathed in light, right? Mm-hmm. So that's an insight into how I think and how I work. Whereas somebody else might be, I'm here and, you know, I've just done this, and this, and, you know, I've performed really, really well, and it's much more individual than a team. One is not right or wrong or better or worse than the other, but it gives you an insight into how they're going to work, and then you can work out, is this what I need for, you know, this particular role?
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of what I'm looking for, and it's much more a conversation.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that's a very forward-looking and timeless approach to hiring. And, you know, when I think back to probably some of my most memorable experiences when I had to hire others, you know, I think back to my very first year in the pharmaceutical industry when I was a postdoctoral fellow. Essentially, I was a contractor. And I was working at a large company in headquarters that underwent a hostile takeover. So I was uncertain, as was my manager and our, you know, entire division about our future, but I was also in charge of hiring the next incoming fellow to replace me, you know, and, I screened and discussed many different candidates. And there was this one particular one that was just very prepared, and she was very polished, more polished than I was at that time. Right. Very hardworking. And, I remember spending hours, right, in the cubicle, like, you know, after work, after 5 o'clock, spending hours proactively, even calling this candidate to you know, describe to her why I found that fellowship so valuable to me and why she needed to join it despite that uncertainty, because I knew she was going to get other offers from other companies, you know. And she ended up taking the role. It took a lot of convincing and persuasion, you know, and she's gone on to become an executive in this industry. But that one incident to me, you know, as I think back to how, what is the current standard of practice in hiring, you know, it reminds me of, okay, you know, maybe hiring should be a conversation like you just, you know, discussed. Right. Maybe we don't need to have time rule us when we hire people, and when, you know, maybe many of us, despite the experience that we have or the status or our background or credentials, maybe it's not a position where the hiring person considers themselves to have that advantage or that perceived advantage or that pedestal or that freedom to choose, but rather they approach it from a conversational, they make that process informal, because I don't believe that a job search needs to be more difficult, more complex than the job itself, which ultimately becomes, I think, right? So I love contests and I love competitions, and I think we all participate in competitions at one time or another when we need, you know, to make a transition and job. But it's the approach ultimately of the decision maker that often is so variable, I think. You know, I think that we, when making this process formal and we drag it out over time and we create a lot of, you know, steps, in order to filter different candidates, different experiences, we, in the process, we lose on getting to know the person and what they can bring, their potential, I think. And we'll lose the time efficiency of that decision as well, where, you know, it becomes sort of a judgment of performance, of short-term performance, that very often throughout my career, I've seen that I've observed has not, you know, translated into success, or long-term high performance or consistent high performance, like you mentioned. So, that's just my opinion that I wanted to share with you, Leon.
I've worked at companies that have had very complex hiring processes, and including bringing the candidate in for 2 days and putting them through a whole lot of presentations and role plays and all of those sorts of things. And I think it's probably incredibly taxing on the people who are hiring. Doesn't make your decisions any better. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced it does. It'd be lovely to see the research, but the companies believe that it does if they're doing it and spending a lot of resources to do it. But in the end, I think, you know, it's about reflecting what's going to happen. And work is a conversation. So I think, you know, if you can have a conversation with someone in a job interview, which is, let's face it, a pretty high stress situation, then I think, you know, then you can have that conversation with them at work, and, you know, you can have that conversation when things get pretty tight. I remember the first person that I ever hired in the industry was associate medical director at a company, and I was the medical department, and I hired someone for medical information, and the company headquarters, the location, was undergoing building at the time, construction, and it was happening just outside my office, and this guy was in my office and we were having a chat, and suddenly the construction started outside the window, and it absolutely derailed everything. And it was his response to that that I looked at and said, I want this person, right? It didn't faze him. He took it in his stride, and I thought, right, this is a guy that I know I can count on under pressure. He's not going to get fazed by things. We can still carry on the conversation. And he was fantastic, one of the best hires I ever had.
Oh, that's a great example. Yeah, and when I think back to my first full-time role, Leon, as a medical science liaison, I remember that I probably didn't answer one question the way the hiring manager or that team was expecting, but I answered very genuinely, authentically, and I was tested. I mean, the presentation stopped working, you know, but I continued it. Nevertheless, I knew it. They asked me one very complex question, very specific question that I was able to answer correctly. And that was not unequivocal. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't subjective. But the other questions, I probably, you know, any coach, any interview coach would tell you these are all no-nos, but I answered them accurately as I, you know, generally. But I nevertheless got that job, you know. And afterwards, I asked the manager, and he told me that I passed the kindergarten test. What he called the kindergarten test of being a person. So he read me as a person above and beyond the, you know, the experiences, the resume, because I was a newcomer. I was probably not very competitive in the pool, you know, coming into a large company. So that's what, you know, your experience just made me think about as well. I think it's about also the distance that you create as a hiring manager giving that position. I think many of us maybe fall under the faulty approach of thinking that we need to create a distance in order for us to give us time to make a decision or to test whether or not, just how serious are they? Are they going to reach out, right? And so we start to play games and we make a contest, but in the meantime, we don't get to know the person. And I know that's a challenge when you have a large pool, but I think decision-making is so important. That's, you know, and maybe decreasing this distance you have from the candidate and being on equal terms, you know, and sometimes actually picking up the phone. If something's bothering you about that, if there's a deal breaker, maybe it's possible to give him a call, right? Or respond to that text message, right? If you offer your candidate to text them anytime with questions, and then you don't follow up when they do text you, then you don't really, you know, you don't decrease the distance. You only increase it. You know, how much of an effort is that candidate going to give you, even if you do hire him, right? So these are just some cases that I've seen, that I've observed.
The other thing that I will always do when I'm interviewing and hiring a candidate is think about the admin staff who are, you know, meeting the candidate and escorting the candidate and taking them around during the day. I will always ask them their opinion of the person, because that's where they see the real person, not the interviewing person. And it's really interesting, the insights that you can get.
So we spoke a lot about sports, and I do want to tell you that you know, the teams like this latest champion that we have in soccer now, I don't know if you were watching Euro 2020. So you're not a soccer fan or football fan, as the British call, or everyone else other than the United States.
And Australia.
And Australia. Oh, so you guys call it football as well, right?
No, we call it soccer.
Okay.
Yeah. And so just as a bit of a lesson about Australia, depending on where you are.
Right.
Football is either, if you're in from Melbourne or Adelaide or Perth, football is Australian rules. If you're from Sydney or Brisbane, football is rugby.
Oh, okay. Got it. Yeah, well, I'll just summarize then the profile of this coach for you, because I follow soccer since I can remember, and I follow the Italian team growing up in the Republic of Georgia. Since the age of four, I still have shirts, Italian shirts from dating back 27 years. And, there was this one coach who inherited a team that failed to make the World Cup, you know, that has nevertheless 6 World Cup championships to its name, Italy. Sorry, four. It's second to Brazil. It's tied with Germany. But he's not, this particular coach never... was never able to win any trophies, any World Cups or Euro, European championships. And he wasn't a flashy player or someone who has had a lot of charisma, let's say, or who had a lot of emotions that he expressed. He didn't show a lot of outward emotions or character. Yet he was able to create an intensity of emotion in this team this year. And for the last 3 years, they've been undefeated for 34 games, and they just won the championship, the European championship, right? And so he created this true, like, championship spirit. And then it's been a team since day one of this championship, which started a month ago, that I found it very different and, like, really memorable. I mean, these guys had heart, you know, not just because I follow Italy. It's been kind of an opinion of many, to say the least. So, what does it take to create the best teams that you led or you were a part of? How do you give those extra responsibilities as a leader?
I think you have to show trust in people. I think you, again, it's...
Have you had to do that? Oh, sorry.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, have you had to give trust to someone on some of your teams that were most memorable, that, you know, were not high performers, but that you saw transformed?
Yeah, I have. And I think, it's, you've got to think about the individual, you've got to think about the team, you've got to think about what the potential consequences are. There's not a lot of things that are necessarily world-ending if you make a mistake. So I think you have to be a little bit sort of pragmatic about stuff as well. But yes, you have to show your team that you trust them, that you have faith in them, and let them do things. So letting someone present to top management. And, letting them have the limelight and that experience. And number two, saying, I trust you to do that. You need to give them all of the support and coaching and, give them all of the right training to get there and to do it and to have them feel confident, but then you've got to let them do it. I've done that a few times with people and, teaching people to have difficult conversations as a manager, and, you know, sort of coached them and then sat in with them, but, you know, just there to as a parachute more than anything else. So, you know, it's not that hard if you want, if your goal is to have the best team possible and to really push your people forward and to develop people, I don't think it's that hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I recently read Tim Grover's book, Winning. Tim Grover, you know, the trainer of Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, and he reminds us about the sacrifices that we make. He reminds us about the sacrifices that we make when we want to win, right? That leave no room for balance. You strike me as a person who has won and who's maintained balance and character and great good humor and great spirits. So I'm just interested in your reaction to his statement of the following. He says that we need to embrace fear because it teaches us what we need to do to win, while doubt teaches us what we need to do in order not to lose. So how have you managed fear versus doubt throughout your life or throughout, you know, those individuals that you led?
Yeah, interesting question. And I think I'm not sure I agree with his statement.
No? No, interesting.
So I'm not sure if there's an overlap in my mind. And again, it comes down to definitions. There's an overlap in my mind between doubt and fear. I don't think they're totally separate and different.
Yeah, it's a spectrum, right?
Yeah. So, I think certainly when you listen to people who, you know, again, back to my Australian Rules days and, you know, my Australian Rules team and one of the champions of that team who has recently been the coach of that team, and I've heard him speak on numerous occasions and gone to, you know, heard him speak on leading and coaching, etc. I'm not sure that it's what is the more powerful motivator, that desire to not lose or the desire to win? And I'm not sure. And I think it's different for different people. So it's that reward versus punishment. Some people are motivated very much by the reward, mm-hmm. and some people are motivated very much more by the avoidance of punishment or the avoidance of pain. And if losing provides that much pain, you will do whatever it takes to avoid that pain.
So
I think it's a little bit more subtle and complex than that. And as I said, I don't necessarily see that much of a difference between fear and doubt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That's fair. Yeah. Interesting perspective. And that's why I wanted to ask you for your opinions on some statements that I think are intriguing, that I found intriguing as well. Leon, you know, I thank you very much, you know, for sharing a lot of your perspectives and stories and examples. If you could share one timeless lesson, story or two, if you like, you have all the time you like to take. What would it be? You know, what would you want to share with those who are going to tune in to All Out Coach?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I think I'd like to believe I have lots of lessons for people, because certainly have lots of lessons for me.
I confirm that, being a colleague, a teammate and friend, yeah. Mentee.
Yeah, thank you. So I think you mentioned, just as we were talking then about that quote, you talked about sacrifices and balance. Mm-hmm. And I have to admit, I have a visceral reaction when people talk about work-life balance. I don't believe it's such a thing. I think it's the wrong thing.
So you agree with Tim Grover on that point. I see.
I do. I think there is just balance. I think the problem is when you talk about work-life balance, you suddenly have a dichotomy. There's work and there's life, whatever that means, right? And it needs to be balanced, and one is good and one is bad, because that's what people walk away with. Work is bad, life is good.
Right.
And so you need to have more life and less work because that's good. And I don't think that's true. And I think it's about, there are so many things and aspects of our lives that we need to balance. And we balance that according to our personal priorities. And I know one of the things my wife keeps telling me all the time is, you've got to get a hobby. Because she says, my hobby is work. And so for me, if I'm enjoying it, if you're doing something that you love and that you're passionate about, it's not work, right? Again, that casts work as bad and not work as good. But what I'm saying is it's about the overall balance, and that what you need for balance shifts all the time anyway and from moment to moment. But I think if you approach things as this is what I'm doing, to earn my living or because I love it or whatever it is, and this is what I'm doing because it interests me and because I enjoy spending time with my family and friends, etc. How do I balance all of that as opposed to one versus the other? Then when you need to, you spend more time automatically on one than the other. Yes, you might need to do a bit of a sacrifice at times to get to what you want on either side. But, it doesn't become a sacrifice per se. You don't necessarily feel like you're losing out on something. You're just changing your priorities for that period of time.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Leon. Thanks so much for being my guest here on Aloha Coach, for continuing to support me as a person, as a professional, as a teammate, as a friend. We're going to speak again, I know, Aloha Coach, after the Olympics are over, anytime you like. You're welcome to, come and visit, let us know your next direction or focus or projects. So thank you very much. Leon Rosen, everyone.
Thank you, Tim. It's been great. I've enjoyed it very much.
Likewise.